session number 13573, Reel 1.
This is an interview with Mr. Bert Jones, recorded by Rodney Giesler in Wooden Bassett, Wiltshire, on October the 26th, 1993.
Could you tell me, first of all, Mr. Jones, your date of birth?
Yes, it's 6th of December, 1919. That's right. Sometimes I have to think hard to remember that.
And really what I'd like to know to begin with is you know, what was your background? Were you interested in flying at all before the war came? Or?
I think every young man, youth, was interested in flying, especially things like the Schneider Trophy going on and there was a lot of interest in flying.
What were you doing before the war?
I worked for Cadbury's, the chocolate making people. I was a confectioner there.
Is that in Bristol or?
No, Birmingham this was. Bourneville, Birmingham. Mm-hmm. That was before they took over Fry's, just after the war, didn't they? Sometime after the war. But they were individual companies in those days. And, we lived in the Birmingham district. And, as I say, I think most young men were interested in flying, but not very few of them had a chance of doing anything about it. But then 1938 was Munich, wasn't it?
Yeah.
1938, yes. When Chamberlain came back from Munich, I and a school friend of mine, Norman Stainton, decided that there was going to be a war. And so we decided to go and volunteer for the RAF Volunteer Reserves. And
was that a bit like the army territorial?
Well, it was similar idea to the territorial army. You went weekends and so many weeks in the summer, you know, at camp, and you trained into various jobs. And for some reason, it didn't. We were accepted. I was accepted, and. War broke out before I actually went in, so I had to wait for them to call me up, you see, as a reserve. I hadn't done any training in the reserves, but I was registered as a reservist. And
I hadn't done any flying
or anything, you see, but eventually they sent for me, and I started training in early 1940. And I trained as a WOP AG, a Wireless Operator Air Gunner. What happened to my school friend, I don't know, because I didn't ever see him again, until later on, that was. And I trained in Reception Depot, with the square batting, we used to call it, in... getting old, and I can't remember names so easily.
Would that be
Uxbridge? Where the balloons are.
Oh, Cardington?
Cardington, that's it, yeah. Cardington, where we all had what they call the Cardington cough. We just did pure and simple square batting there. Then I moved to... Prestwick in Scotland, where we started a radio course. And then from Prestwick I came back to Cranwell, where we finished the radio course off flying as wireless operators. When we finished that course...
What did you fly on that course at Cranwell?
Only small proctors and things like that, you know. Just a pilot and the wireless operator in the back behind him, crammed in. with one exception, they had what we used to call the flying pig there. It was one of these great old biplanes with push and pull props. And I forget what it was. What the
push and pull, propeller in front and a propeller behind.
That's right, yeah. Oh. And it used to work up to a max.
Excuse me.
Used to work up to a maximum speed of 60 miles an hour. It was one of those things that when they used it in a bombing raid in the First World War, they would open the side door and throw the bomb at you. So if you're in a, if you met a 60 mile an hour headwind or higher than 60 miles an hour, you went backwards.
Well, this was in 1940.
That's right, yeah. But it, when we finished that, passed out as wireless operators on that course, we went to Dumfries and we did the bombing and gunnery courses. And there was nothing. Nothing to really talk about. We trained on everything from. I was trained on a Smith & Wesson 38 handgun. 12-bore shotguns. We did clay pigeon shooting to get used to the idea of deflection and all the rest of it. And because guns with the circular pan on them, because K guns, I think they were, and Brownings. And when we passed out there and we were sent off to an operational training unit where we were crewed up and did practice operational flights to get used to the idea, I suppose. And from there I was posted to 124 Squadron at Stratishall in Bomber Command 3 Group, East Anglia, Suffolk, anyway. And that's where I did my operations from.
This is on Wellington, isn't it?
On Wellington, yeah. Wellington Mark 2s, I think they were at that time. And I remember the first time I went there, we went from an operational training unit as a crew. But when we got to the squadron, 124, the CO said, well, you're all green, you can't go out as a crew like that, so what we'll do is we'll take away the captain of the crew, the first pilot, and we'll give you an experienced pilot. And then you can go out, set off like that. So we were sat outside the flight office there, and there was this fella doing circuits and bumps in the Wellington. They said, he's going to be the captain of your crew, and his name is Jones. So we sat watching this fella circle around, and he came into land, and he landed downwind and ran into a ditch. So the CO decided that he wasn't experienced enough and he gave us another one. Man, person named Leslie Hancock, and that's the crew. We flew as that crew all the time. Apart from one exception, and the CO, I think his name is McFadden, we had about three COs the time I was there because their turnover was equally as high as ours. And this was June, about June 4th, I think, 1941. And the first of the blockbuster bombs came in. We usually carried 250 pounds, 500 pound bombs, something like that, in a bomb load. And they started building these 4,000 pounds of the first one, and then they went up to 8, didn't they? And some of them were huge later on, I know, but the first of those bombs were 4,000 pound bombs. And one was delivered to our squadron. Posed a bit of a problem because any bombing raid was pretty well long distance from England to almost anywhere on the continent for those days, and the capabilities of the Wellingtons, the weight carrying capabilities, they had to be very careful about the ratio of bomb load to fuel load. And we normally carried about 2,500 pounds of bombs, and the rest was all fuel, you see.
So your range was a bit limited.
This was a 4,000 pound bomb, so it meant that they were going to cut it a bit fine. But this CO was mad keen that he was going to drop this on Berlin, this bomb. So they adapted a Wellington, and it. The bomb doors remained open, and the bomb just, you could see half the bomb hanging below the aircraft, you see, and that's how it flew out to Berlin. But he wanted to raise a crew, so he asked me to fly as front gunner for him. And all the rest of the crew were sort of old hands, you know. And we flew off about 7 o'clock in the evening in daylight. We got to Berlin, no incidents whatever, and dropped this bomb. And the aircraft just shot up about 1,000 feet as they dropped this, and turned around and came back again. The snag was, it really was cut fine, and we ran out of juice just round by Bury St Edmunds coming back to Stradishaw. And we crash-landed there in a field which had been prepared with telegraph pole-type things, anti-invasion things, you know, anti-glider...
Obstructions,
yeah. And, and we hit one of those obstructions, and I wasn't out of the front turret, so I got knocked about a bit there. And ended up in the RAF hospital in Ely. And when I'd recovered sufficiently, they sent me to Blackpool on convalescence. The hotel in the South Shore in Blackpool. Now, I mentioned that I'd joined the volunteer reserves with this Norman Stainton, a school pal of mine. And I hadn't seen him since those days in 1939. But I walked into this hotel, standing in the reception place was Norman Stainton. He was a gunner. And of course, the first thing you say to each other is, what the hell are you doing here, you know? And he had done a tour of operations, and they'd brought him off on rest. And the rest they were giving him was to fly as a gunner on night fighters. And they were the night fighters that had bolt and pull four-gun turrets, mid-upper turrets. I forget.
It was
the,
on a Blenheim,
was it? No. It was a fighter aircraft.
Defiant.
That's right. Bolt and pull Defiant. That's it. And the only means of access and exit from pardon me, from a defiant turret is through the bottom to drop out onto the ground, you see. His pilot was an ex-Spitfire pilot, and they were stationed at Ringway in Manchester, and they went up one night, and coming back, apparently Manchester has, at that time, had a long runway and a short runway. And the short runway ended up near a brick wall, and the Spitfire pilot, used to fairly short runways, landed on the short runway, and of course he was in a heavier bolt and pull, and decided he wasn't going to be able to stop before he got to the wall, so the pilot jumped out and left my friend Stainton sitting in the turret at the back, and he ended up in the same convalescent home as myself. That's the only time we ever met, isn't it, during the war, and haven't met him since.
Well, you were pretty young on average, weren't you, going back to Wellington's? I mean, you were 21.
I was 21st birthday, when was that? End of 1940, wasn't it? Or 41.
I don't know, I know you had your money stolen, didn't you? What was
that to you? December 1940, I think I was 21, that's right. Yeah. The crew, my crew, was the pilot was about, the skipper was about 24 years old, 23 or 24. The second pilot was 19 years old. The navigator, there again, he was about 23, 24. I was 21. The other, well, the two wireless operators, he was 20, 21. And the tower gunner was about 22, 21 or 22. So we were quite elderly, really, except for the second pilot for those days.
The pilot presumably was commissioned, was he, or were you?
Oh no, we were there? Sergeants all.
The whole lot of you.
We used to have little meetings, you know, to plan tactics and what we should do if ever we met a night fighter. And we decided on certain tactics. Never thinking that we ever should need them. But the last flight I was on, when I was taken prisoner, we went to Stettin. There again, it was a long flight, so a lot of fuel and a lot of fine balancing between bomb loads and fuel loads. And this was quite eventful for us, really, because the first thing about our Wellingtons that we were using on the wireless sets, we were using what they called TR 1082-1083. It was a 1082 was the transmitter and 1083 was the receiver. A bit old fashioned for the day. And we came back from an operation on the 29th of September. And while we were sleeping it off during the day, the ground fitters installed a new wireless set. We turned over to a Marconi, which was really a step forward in that sort of equipment. We were very pleased about that. But we didn't have any chance to test it in the air. Of course, that night we went straight off again to Stettin. And over the North Sea, we decided to give this a tryout, and of course, the damn thing didn't work. So there was I and the John Pollitt, his name, the other radio operator, were spending all our time fault-finding and panicking around, trying to find out what was wrong, you see. And with the two engines we have, there are two generators, one on each engine. This one was connected to the generator on the port engine. As a last resort, we changed that connection over to the generator on the starboard engine, and it went like a charm. So from there on, we were all right.
Weren't you supposed to keep radio silent on those trips?
Yes, but it was a new set, you see. It was just as well we did try it, otherwise it... when we did need it, we would have been without one. And, of course, you're listening out all the time, and if you're not getting any noise through it, you think, oh, goodness, what's wrong? From there on, that's the first incident in that that particular operation. The second one, when we were... Our course was across the North Sea and cross over, across the coast round about Denmark and straight up the other side to Stettin. And it was there, when we were approaching Denmark, that the tail gunner spotted a night fighter. I think it was a Messerschmitt 110, he said. Of course, we couldn't see it. He was the only one that saw it. So we went into our agreed tactics, which was to side slip occasionally from one side to the other, just gently, you know, not to, no sort of exaggerated movement. So they started doing that, and this Jerriac started firing, and we were tracer to the left and tracer to the right and tracer down to the left. And by the time he'd fired those up, he was within range, and the tail gunner started firing, and he just disappeared. So we think he shot him down, but we couldn't claim it because we didn't see what happened to him. That was the second incident. So from there on, we carried on to Stettin. Coming back, we decided we might be a little bit short of juice. So they cut the corner off a little bit, and it brought us into the Hamburg area on the way back. And there was nothing about it, there was no flak, no searchlights or anything, but the port engine.
This was about 1941 you're talking about?
This is September, September 30th, 1941. And the port engine packed up. First we knew about it, the plane just started whipping around in circles, naturally all the power, but we managed to get it straightened out. But we were losing height, so we dashed about, stripping everything out, throwing guns overboard, everything we could move, we chucked it over. So I don't know what the poor people were thought was happening, if anyway. But it made no difference, we were still losing height, so we had to bail out when we were down to about 1,000 feet, I think it was. And that was the end of it, really, except that as I jumped out to start with, the parachutes was another thing. You never expect to use anything like this, of course, you know, it's never going to happen to you. So we used to use sit on them. If we had any spare time, we'd gather the any quiet trips, we'd gather in the back and play three-handed whist, all sitting on our the navigator and the two wireless operators would be playing whist or something like that, sitting on the parachutes. So when I came to use mine, it clipped under the chest. When I jumped out and pulled a ripcord, nothing happened. So I was in a mad panic and just pulled the front like that, and fortunately it opened it up and away it went. And
what, the ripcord didn't pull properly the first time?
Well, I think, you pull the pin out of the ripcord and the flaps are braced on the elasticated straps, which are meant to pull the flaps open to allow the pilot chute to come out. Well, that didn't happen. Pull the ripcord out and they just stayed where they were. There was a little bit of white showing, and I snatched at that, and it fortunately set it off and saved my bacon. On the way down, it I thought a flare had gone off or something with a great light, which continued as I came down. I thought I'd been spotted. They were watching me come down or something like that. But what happened was that the plane had crashed, and I was told later that it crashed into two houses. There was some sort of... This was on the bank of the River Elbe, I think it was. And it was some sort of small habitation, a village of some sort, I suppose. And it had crashed into two of the houses at the end of a row and sort of set them on fire, and that's what was lighting me up as I came down. And I landed in the field, some sort of plants in them, I don't know if they're beet tops or something, quite tall green tops. And I could hear people running about and shouting, fire bells going, and I thought it might be a bit too dodgy for me to be seen walking about, so I wrapped myself in my parachute and lay in the field all night until the next early morning when it was all quiet. Then I decided to start walking, and I stopped at I walked from the field to the road, which ran alongside the river, and came across this farmhouse, and I knocked on the back door, because I didn't really know where I was. I didn't know that I was in the Hamburg area to start with. I knocked on the door, mainly to find out where I was. Of course, some old lady came to the door and was very excited, so I thought I'd better exit, and I tottered off and just started walking west. And I walked for some time, actually. I was walking through this village, and three soldiers came cycling past and went right past, and they must have cycled on for 50 or 60 yards further before I heard this yell, you see, so I turned round and they were there with their rifles pointed at me. So I just put my hands up and waited. And they came back and checked out who I was and said, "Oh, we're looking for you." Yes, and for you the war is over, sort of thing. And I said, "What made you cycle past if you were looking for some suspicious character like me?"
They understood English, obviously.
One of them understood English, yeah. And he said, "Well, I was in blue, you see. I got an Irving jacket, flying jacket on, flying boots. I'd thrown my helmet away, I hadn't got a cap. And he said, "We thought you may be one of ours, but you didn't salute us."